Make haste.
Doing push-ups in your room. Posters all around you. Footballers, rappers, superheroes, bands. Swimming star Michael Phelps. The youngest man ever to break a world record. Aged 15 years, 9 months. The Star Wars duvet. And all your old toys on the shelves. Lego, Boglins, Zoids. You feel like you're camped out in the room of another boy. You feel like the replacement boy they've got in after something awful happened. You move through the house as if you've been programmed with information about it. The kitchen radio pops and frazzles every time you cross its path. The magpies chatter like machine guns. Their claws scrape on the shed's tin roof. The drain refilled every morning with worn-out grey hairs. Dad holds the book, but never turns the page. And the door stays closed all day. You got a sec, Danny? I need to talk to you about something. Sure thing, Dad. This came this morning. Dad waves a pink slip of paper in his left hand. It's Skippy's midterm progress card. Oh. Yeah. We need to have a talk about it. I mean, we should probably have a talk anyway, shouldn't we? They sit down at the table. Dad grips the underside of his chair and turns it diagonally so he's facing Skippy. This close, he seems very big, a bear crammed into a kitchen chair. His breath smells of whiskey. Skippy sits very still and peeks sideways at the card lying next to them on the table. A line of C's and D's. And at the bottom in someone's slapdash, grown-up writing, probably the automator's. Disappointing. Must try harder. First of all, is there anything you'd like to say about these grades, Danny? Well, no. I mean, they're disappointing. No, I mean, I'm wondering if there's some reason. Like, if they gave the tests that time when you were sick. No. Dad's eyes pour into his. He tries to think of something else to say. I'm sorry, he says. I suppose I'll just have to try harder. Dad exhales. It's the wrong answer. What I'm wondering is, he says. Obviously, what I'm wondering is, are you having difficulty concentrating at the moment? Are you finding it hard to focus on this stuff? Skippy makes a carefully thinking it over face. No, not really. No, I wouldn't say so. You haven't found you've got too much on your mind to... No. Skippy sounds like he's surprised by the question. No, nothing like that. And yet these grades are way down. Skippy looks at Dogley, telepathically trying to call him over. You're not on trial here, sport. I'm just trying to find out, you know... Skippy takes a deep breath. Well, maybe it's just taking me a while to settle into senior school. I think I just need to settle in more and try harder. Dad stares at him. The sour tang of whiskey. The metallic hum of the refrigerator. That's it? Mm-hmm. Skippy nods firmly. Dad sighs and looks off to the left. Danny, in certain situations, well, let me put it this way. In my own work, personally speaking, I can find it difficult at the moment to care about what I'm doing. I was wondering if you felt that at all. Skippy's eyes smart with tears. What is Dad trying to do here? Why is he trying to catch him out? He does not reply, blinks at him to say, What? It's not the grades that bother me, sport. Dad doesn't notice. It's more the thought that you might be feeling like... His clasped hands dip between his knees like the head of a dead bird. Then, in a new voice, he says, I suppose what I'm thinking is, maybe we made a mistake in our original plan. Maybe we didn't foresee quite how long it would take for things to pan out. Don't you think it might make more sense if we arranged for some kind of... If I spoke to your Mr. Costigan and said to him, Well, Here's our situation, just so you're aware. Dad, Skippy thinks. What are you doing? What about the game? Don't you know what happens when you talk about it? Don't you remember what happened last time? I know you said you didn't want to do that, and obviously I'm going to respect that decision. I'm just wondering if it's something you've thought about since, just as something that might take the pressure off you a little bit. Skippy keeps his mouth tight shut, slowly shakes his head. You're sure? Dad's eyebrow raised, pleading. Skippy nods, just as slowly. Dad drags his hands over his face. I just hate to think of you off at Seabrook. I mean, we want you to be happy, if you can, Danny. That's what we want. I am happy, Dad. Sure. Okay. I know that. Hold tight to your chair. Wait for it to end. The pills in the drawer in your room. Okay. Dad throws his hands up. I guess we'll just see how it goes then. He smiles mirthlessly. End of interrogation, he says. You get up to go. Inside you feel cold, hollow, like a ruined castle with the wind gusting through it. Whoosh, whoosh. Hey, I was thinking of going for a swim tomorrow after work, down to the pool. You interested? No, I'm okay, thanks. You don't need to practice for the race. No. Coach said it wasn't so important. Really? Yeah, actually he said we should take a break from it. I might take Dogley for a walk. Come on, boy. He swings the collar and lead over him, and Dogley reluctantly rises from his bed. Nights are the worst. Outside, the fireworks explode like cluster bombs. Through the walls, the cries are like missiles screaming into your heart. But in the secret compartment of memory where Frisbee Girl is waiting, everything's just like it was. Her hands, her hair, her eyes, her voice, singing her secret song. The moment picks you up and swirls you into it. You lose yourself again in her sideways eights, and everything real fades away to a dream. That week of midterm is the longest of Howard's life. The house has never seemed so small, so confining, like an underground bunker shared with a ricocheting bullet that zings off the walls night and day, hour after hour. His teeth ache from smiling vacantly. His muscles throb from maintaining his meticulously arranged slouch on the sofa. Everyday conversation is like juggling fire. Hallie's most basic inquiry.
Are we out of milk?
Setting off a mental pandemonium. Every synapse blazing in the panic to construct a reply before the delay becomes obvious. By the second day, he is fantasizing about throwing himself at her feet, confessing everything, simply to bring an end to this exhausting assault on his nerves. Then he discovers an escape route. Thinking he'd better avoid antagonizing the automator any further, he goes into the school library Monday morning and borrows a couple of books on Seabrook history as research for his piece for the concert program. Both are written by the same stylistically unblessed priest, and breathtakingly dull. But while he is reading them, Hallie leaves him alone. He spends 2 days blissfully submerged in the mind-numbing minutiae of Seabrook's past. When he is finished, he returns to the library and asks the psoriatic brother in charge if he has anything else on the school. The brother does not. For a moment, Howard is at sea. Then he has a brainwave.
How about the First World War?
There are 17 books on the First World War. Howard checks out all of them. At home, he piles them around him on the living room table and reads with an engrossed, not-to-be-disturbed expression. He even keeps a box of candles beside him for when the construction work on the science park knocks the power out.
You're really getting into that stuff.
Hallie says, regarding the stacks of books, their stern, catastrophic covers.
Oh, you know, it's for the kids.
He replies abstractedly, and peers into the page to make an imaginary underlining. For the rest of the week, he does nothing but read. Textbooks and yarns, elegies and entertainments, eyewitness accounts, and fusty Donnish histories. He reads them all. And on every page he sees the same thing. Miss McIntyre's white body, stretched out before him, her mouth straining for his, her intoxicated, half-closed eyes. He aches to talk to her. Her absence, his powerlessness to reach her, are agonizing. One evening, he ends up telling Farley what happened, just so he can speak her name. Even sketching it minimally down the phone line brings the electricity of that night thrilling through him again, with a strange mixture of shame, pride, shame at his pride. But Farley does not seem to share it. Instead, he is somber, as if Howard had announced some fatal illness.
So what are you going to do?
I don't know.
What about Hallie?
I don't know.
These are all the questions he has avoided asking himself. Why is Farley asking them?
I think I'm in love with Aurelie.
Howard realizes this only as he says it.
You're not, Howard. You barely know her.
What difference does that make?
It makes all the difference. You've been with Hallie for 3 years. If you mess it up now, I promise you'll regret it.
So what do you suggest I do? Pretend it never happened? Just bury my feelings away, is that it?
I'm just telling you what you already know, which is that this thing with Aurelie is a fantasy. It's a fantasy, you know it. And now you've had your fun, you should let it go. You haven't told Hallie anything, have you?
No.
Okay, well, keep it that way. In my experience, honesty is definitely not the best policy with these things. Just sit tight until things are clearer. If she asks, deny everything.
Howard is angry. How many of Farley's fantasies has he listened to over the years? Chewing Howard's ear off about the new waitress in the deli, the new assistant in the pharmacy, the girl at the internet cafe with the incredible jugs. All of them conquered, or, mostly, otherwise, forgotten completely 2 weeks later. Who is he to sermonize? Who is he to dictate what is and isn't real? To say what Howard is or isn't feeling? Just because he likes having friends who are living the straight life, likes being able to come over to a nice house where he can eat a nice dinner and tell his wild stories, vicariously enjoy the stability and routine for a night without ever having to submit to the slog of it, the endless strictures and limitations. Later on, however, when the initial sting has abated, he admits to himself that Farley might have a point. Yes, Miss McIntyre is beautiful. Yes, what happened in the geography room was exhilarating. But did it actually mean anything? He's back on the couch with his books. On the other side of the room, Hallie taps at her computer, cigarette smoke gathered at her shoulder, a spectral familiar. People do crazy things. Aurelie said it herself. They do arbitrary things to test the boundaries, to feel free. But those moments don't have any meaning beyond themselves. They don't have any real connection with who you are. They aren't life. Life is when you're not doing something arbitrary to feel free. This is life. This living room. The furniture and trappings they have picked out and paid for with slow hours of work. The small treats and fancies their budget has allowed them.
You look deep in thought,
Hallie says from her desk.
Just straightening something out,
he says. She gets up.
I'm going to make a smoothie. Do you want one?
That'd be great. Thanks.
A life and a place to live it versus a momentary flame of passion. For a grown man, that should hardly be a difficult choice. Confident he's on the right track now, he sets it out mathematically, constructing an elaborate equation in his head in order to prove it to himself beyond any doubt. On one side, he places his relationship with Hallie, factoring in as much as he can, the loneliness of his life before he met her, the sacrifices she has made for him, their relative happiness together, as well as more abstract concepts like loyalty, honesty, trust, what it means to be a good person. On the other side... On the other side, Miss McIntyre's mouth, her eyes, her nails in his back. Hallie is asking something from the kitchen.
What?
He calls hoarsely.
Are you in a blueberry mood or a pineapple mood?
Oh, whatever you think.
His voice, strained, high, adolescent, melds into the turbulent whine of the blender. Leaned up loosely against the geography room door, telling him, to be bored, that's really a crime. Howard has been so bored. He has been so bored with Howard, and all the accoutrements of being Howard. He does not hold Hallie to blame for this. Boredom is congenital to cowards, like thin blood is to Russian royalty. But the fact remains that in the geography room he had not felt bored. In the geography room, lying back in the darkness, he'd felt like he was waking from a long, long sleep.
Here you go.
Hallie hands him a tall, cold glass, runs her fingers through his hair on the way back to her computer.
Oh, thanks.
Well, maybe for now the best thing would be to wait. Until he returns to school and finds the lie of the land. Maybe he should take Farley's advice. Keep his head below the parapet. And Hallie, stealthily, unnoticeably, via a careful weave of mishearings and mistimings, at arm's length, make do for now with secret visits to his memory, replaying his store of orally moments, imagining their future life together. A smiling haze of uncomplicated rightness. He sips down cold, citrusy pulp, picks up his book, and sinks into a fantasy in which he walks with her side by side over war-torn earth, through shards of former trees and khaki-shrouded limbs that reach plaintively up out of the ground. He, a Tommy, covered head to toe in mud. She, spotless, in a cream angora sweater, giving him a pop quiz on his own life he has not studied for, but to which she, fortunately, has all the answers.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook, so please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.